I'd say this is the biggest missional opportunity since the Billy Graham rallies first came to this country in the 50s.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity. That's the magazine that sponsors this show and brings it to you every week. It's the UK's leading Christian magazine. Check out our latest subscription offers now and join our community of readers at premierchristianity.com. Today on the show, I'm really pleased to say that my guest is Luke Smith. He is the national team leader for Fusion, a Christian organisation committed to championing a worldwide movement of student mission. He's also the author of How to Make Disciples That Make Disciples, and he lives in York with his wife and two children. Luke, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, wonderful to have you in. We always like to go back to the beginning here on the show, so tell me a little bit, if you would, about life growing up.
Yeah, born in Cheltenham but lived in York since I was three, so I don't remember much, but we like to go from one race course to another. So grew up in York. Mum and dad both loved Jesus, brought me to church, have a sister called Coletta, basically hated church, I think, but loved Jesus. So that was kind of the story of my childhood in terms of faith, was around that. Just couldn't get on with it, seemed so dull. I've always just loved the person of Jesus. I just think he's amazing.
That's quite unusual, because often those two things go together, especially as children and teenagers. You find that either someone is in church and loving Jesus, or they're out of church and not loving Jesus. But you actually were loving Jesus but struggling with church.
Yeah, Jesus is just absolutely amazing. But you've got to bear in mind, this was in the 80s, and it was pretty dull. I thought, maybe it still is in some places. But I suppose people my age that were Christians seemed boring, and the kids' work was dull, so I just didn't want to go. I don't really like being controlled, and I felt like I was in a kids' work setting. So I just I hate it here. So my mum did home church for a bit with us when we were kids. And then my dad worked for the Church Mission Society. So that's the other factor about my childhood and faith, is that we often had missionaries staying with us, people from other cultures, Sudanese bishops, Ethiopian Orthodox metropolitans, Russian Orthodox, some amazing people. And my dad would travel. He did trips all around the Middle East, Syria. He wrote a book on that, on the early church, and so then people would visit from that, from those places, and then Pakistan and so on. And so I met these people, and I was like, they're not boring. They're absolutely amazing. I love meeting these people.
Yeah.
But so much of what I saw in this kind of village, Western church, it's just boring. So I'm like, I just don't want to have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
So I kind of lost faith early teenage years, and then gave my life back to Jesus as a teenager at Spring Harvest.
At Spring Harvest. And do you remember that? What happened?
I certainly do remember it. We went along because my parents were doing seminars. So me and my sister went along. I mean, she just loved Jesus, and she just got involved in everything. So she was in the kids' work. She was doing it. She's 4 years younger than me. But I was being a bit of a rebellious teenager and basically spending my time in the snooker hall trying to not go to stuff. And then this girl who I liked.
A girl.
She asked me, do you want to come?
Girl brought you back to church.
Yeah, flirt to convert big time. But so she said, do you want to come and see the Worldwide Message Tribe play? And I knew about the Worldwide Message Tribe because my sister had their CD. This was in 1996. I was 16. I was into Oasis, Rage Against the Machine, Radiohead. I did not want to know about Worldwide Message Tribe.
Because how would you characterize their music? It wasn't Oasis. It was
No, it's like dance band.
Poppy
dance band with a bit of rap.
Rap, yeah.
So I thought, this is awful. I hate dance music. I don't want to, but I quite like her. So I'll go because I'm interested. Anyway, me and her never got together. But that night I saw, but so I just take it back one stage. I wanted to, in my words, I wanted to be an idiot. I just wanted to mess about and be an idiot with my mates. I know not everyone likes the word idiot, but I was like, that's what I would have said at 16. I just want to be an idiot, be a fool. And then I'm watching this band, this dance group, jumping around the stage. And there's this one guy who I'm thinking, well, he looks a lot older than the rest of them. He can't really dance. He can't really rap. He can't really sing. But he's doing it because he really believes in Jesus. And I really believe in Jesus. I know he's real. And I've read all about him all my life. And I think he's amazing. And he's talking about him. And I'm like, I relate to that guy because he looks like an idiot. But then I just felt in my soul kind of thing. I was like, but he's actually God's idiot. But I'm just an idiot. So that night, that was Andy Hawthorne, by the way, in case that wasn't clear. I've talked to him about that since and said, thank you so much.
Thank you for being God's idiot.
Yeah, I told him, I thought, you're an idiot, you're God's idiot. And actually, the first time I told him, I don't think he really liked it. But then he was like, oh, no, I see what you mean. Like, a fool for Christ, I'll take that. But, that night, I was like, if I can be a fool for you, if I can be your idiot, then I'm in. I will commit. That's when I re-gave my life back to Jesus. I was 16.
Wow. And what were your sort of... Did you have any career aspirations at that point, sort of 16, 17?
16, 17, I think I wanted to be a politician. I did politics at uni. I worked for a lawyer for a year before that because I thought maybe that would be helpful. And then just did a year as a gap year working for a lawyer and decided I definitely don't want to be a lawyer. So I did politics. Worked for Nick Clegg for a little bit.
Wow.
That was before he was an MP. It was when he was an MEP, and he was based in Nottingham. I went to uni in Loughborough, and so I worked for him a little bit. But then did a master's in political philosophy. I was just really into that sort of stuff, but didn't take up a career in becoming a political philosopher, as most people don't who study that. And
this could be a very different podcast, couldn't it? We could go into all sorts of political depth right now.
We absolutely could. I mean, I did my master's dissertation on the toleration of Holocaust denial.
Wow.
And whether we ought to tolerate Holocaust deniers who clearly are falsifying history, but should we tolerate it? And so the reason why it is still relevant to me in my life is what do you tolerate that you find offensive? Stuff that you don't agree with, stuff that you think is wrong, stuff that you just think is incorrect. Mm. How much do we tolerate and how much do we go, actually, you can't say that? Mm. And in today's society versus 24 years ago when I did that master's, it is way less tolerant than it was then. And even then it wasn't very tolerant. So there's a whole thing there around free speech and toleration that I think is relevant to each of us who believe things... Well, the gospel's offensive, so, you know, to some. So
it was in the news literally a few days ago from the point of recording this, where a number of Muslims got together in Trafalgar Square to finish the Ramadan fast.
Mm.
And you had a prominent Conservative MP say he doesn't think this event should have been allowed to happen. So, again, this idea that someone I disagree with, that particular person, was saying we should ban this event and shut it down. A number of... other people, including some Christians, said, no, we should allow ideas that we don't agree with in the name of freedom of speech.
Would that be
your view, that we should allow other ideas, even other religious ideas?
Of course, be in dialogue. And also be offended. There's a whole fear of offence. And what happens, when you get offended, what happens is nothing. You've just got offended. That's all that's happened. But you don't act like, oh, I got offended and I twisted my ankle. You know, you don't get hurt, actually, if you're offended. Now, I totally understand that there is a level of offence that could come into what you might call cultural harm, and that's certainly the argument that's made for legislating against Holocaust denial. And I do understand those things, and that will affect different areas too, but I would say the tendency can be to legislate against offending. But the question is, what offends one person doesn't offend another. So if you make laws around that, you're in really tricky territory. Yeah.
As much as we could continue down this fascinating, it's my fault, fascinating rabbit hole that I very much guided you into, we should probably draw ourselves out of political theory. I do that by asking you, why haven't you continued down that road and what did you do instead of working for Nick Clegg?
Yeah. I knew I didn't want to be a politician. Partly through working for Nick Clegg, I actually saw the ins and outs, a little bit similar to the world of a lawyer. of how much the volume of paperwork and tiny detail, which is essentially not that exciting, but very, very important. I was so impressed with the machinery behind the relational machinery behind responding to every single person that writes to you. I wrote back to people that were his constituents about how many wildflowers there were, how many, you know, pollutants there were in the water, all of those things, and they all needed responding to, and I get it. It's just not what I wanted. It's not the hill I wanted to die on, I suppose. I figured this is not going to keep me going. And for every exciting moment that you see in politics, there are 1,000 not very exciting but really important moments where your MP, your local councillor, whoever it is that you might be angry with or frustrated with, I'm like, honestly, they are doing their best. Mm. There might be a couple of rotten apples, but there's, in the vast majority, they are phenomenal. But I just knew I wasn't going to be able to do that. Anyway, so I then went and worked in sales, which is not, it's not like I decided not to become a politician, so I'll go and work in sales. I just knew I don't want to go down that route. And so I started working for a gas fire company selling gas fires. That was just graft. It was amazing. It was a lot of fun. Straight out of uni, they just gave me a state car and all the stuff you need and just went, your region is Chester up to Inverness, go. And it was brilliant fun. At the same time, we planted a church in York called G2, which my wife now leads. That was in 2005. We got married in 2005 as well, so we're... As a marriage, we're the same age as our church.
So you got married and planted the church pretty much at the same time?
Yes, we were part of the team that was planting the church. So she wasn't, and I've never led G2 and she wasn't leading it at the time. But we were part of the team. It was led by someone called Jim, then it was led by someone called Christian, and Hannah's led it for the last 5 years. So, I then I worked for a Parliamentary Brief magazine. So there was a bit more of the politics coming back into it, and I was marketing director there, so selling advertising to companies. Essentially, it's a lobbying magazine to MPs and Lords and senior civil servants. But then just felt really strongly called into Fusion. So we'd planted G2. We were working with students on a local level. I was already giving... I'd gone to 4 days a week with the magazine, and I was just giving a day a week for our church just to relate to students and other people. And I wanted to do more of that. Mm. And I thought, I can't do this marketing job as well as that. And then I thought, I need to do something more with students. And then Fusion came back on my radar. Fusion was started just before I was a student myself in the late 90s. And so I knew about it, and I'd supported Fusion financially since I was a student. And then I just thought, I need to get back in contact with them. I actually had a dream about it the previous year. And in the dream, I phoned up Rich Wilson, led the Fusion team. And in the dream, I told him, I thought, you're amazing and you're doing a great job. So I woke up, and like often happens, I think we overanalyze it. So I just thought, oh, you better just do it. So I phoned him up and told him he was great and he was doing a good job. But that sort of rekindled the friendship a bit.
Okay.
So then a year later, I ended up contacting him saying, I think I might need to do something with students more generally. And so I started working for Fusion and our church. And then I phased out the church bit. I handed it on to other people. And I've been full-time with Fusion for most of that time.
For those who aren't aware, just tell us a bit about Fusion, what it is, why it exists, and what it does.
Yeah, we're a local church organisation. We're just mad passionate about the local church and university students. We think every student deserves an opportunity to find hope in Jesus and home in the local church. So that's our anything to do with students and churches, that's what we knock around with. And we think that's a genius idea. That the local church in each place, it's near a hall of residence, it's near a campus, it's near a university, so one way or another, they're able to love, welcome and disciple students. But they tend to need a little bit of help, confidence and, you know, a bit of tools to
do that. I was going to say, what kind of help
do
they need? Because I think a lot of people say, well, yeah, great, I love local church too. Sure, university students, every September they flood into my university sort of town or city, there's local churches around. What help do they need?
Well, I guess it's a moving culture. So how to relate well to university students now versus 5, 10, 15 years ago is different. They're a different generation who are at uni right now. So church leaders and others need a bit of help figuring out what connects to people right now. But also, I suppose, it's the sheer scale of the number of people that are coming into your place, which I think actually most Christians don't think about it like this. So if I was to say, in your town, there's going to be an influx of 30,000 refugees from a war zone, I hope the church would say in a unified way, well, we're going to see what we can do to help welcome you and rescue you from that difficult situation. So we're going to be a good place. And by the way, they would see themselves as the spiritual key holders to that city or town, I hope. So they should be going, look, what can we do together to welcome these people into our number in this city? Mm. Well, that does happen in university locations all over the place every September. There's this massive influx of people. Okay, maybe only a third of them are new and some of them are returning for the second, third or maybe fourth years. But there's a huge number of people who are new to your place. They don't know. And I'm like, we need to help the church go, this is a great place. You're arriving somewhere where we love. We love this place and we want to help you land here well and thrive in the city. Potentially, lots of them will find faith in Jesus and make a home in your church. But if that's our only interest, instead of just being interested in the best for those people, just to first and foremost say, hey, welcome. Like you would do if there was loads of people arriving. Just welcome. Hi. There's a good hospitality here. And then lots of them, of course, let's talk to them about Jesus because he's the best thing out. But yeah, I think sometimes we're a bit awkward about it. And so we're like, if you want to meet him, then we'll talk to you. Otherwise, we don't know how to talk to you. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I know you've been talking about a shift that you've been seeing amongst young people, amongst students. You've written a piece for Premier Christianity arguing that students are more open to reading the Bible than ever. So you've been doing this ministry for a while.
Mm.
What's changed and what are you seeing?
I would love to know what changed. I can tell you something's changed. I don't quite know what it is. My best description for it is that it felt like an archangel won a battle somewhere in the unseen realm. But I've got no evidence to tell you that that's definitely true. But what I mean by that, it felt like something that I couldn't quite see shifted. It felt like there was cloud and then it lifted. It felt like all of a sudden we can see more clearly. And when we chatted to students on campus, it got easier. They wanted to know about Jesus. They wanted to respond to the gospel. The kind of testimonies we were starting to see changed. So previously, you might expect a testimony at, say, like a baptism service. It might be somebody saying, yeah, my housemate was a Christian and she went to church. And gradually, I got invited to Alpha and I thought that was a good idea. I went and I thought, yeah, that sounds about right. And, you know, it was a sort of gradual journey and somebody thought that kind of makes sense. A bit of a God-shaped hole, whatever, that sort of thing. Whereas the testimonies that we then started to see, and I would pinpoint that to the start of 2023, they started to be somebody saying, I suddenly realized my life was on a road to ruin and it was pointless without God. Or somebody on a park bench saying, I suddenly realized there is a God. What do I do? They're on TikTok going, how do I become a Christian? Somebody walking into a church saying, what do I need to do to repent? That's not language I would have thought students would ask. Equally, people finding faith through reading the Bible and genuinely all over the Bible. I mean, you've probably heard that from other people, but it's not what I would have recommended to read. In other words, I might have said, start with the Gospels, maybe start with Mark. I don't know. But lots of us would have said things like this. But you've got people reading Ecclesiastes and going, God is real. I need it. And I need to find out how to find faith in him. You've got people reading at the start. Most people start at the start of a book, don't they? Lots of people have got halfway through Exodus and then gone, I don't know, there are lots of people who've got halfway through Exodus and given their life to Jesus, but we've heard of a few people who've done that.
Yeah.
And people who've read the Psalms and just gone, I know this is coming from a place of goodness and truth. I need to find more. So people are reading all over Scripture.
Yeah.
In fact, just yesterday, we put somebody called Eleanor that I work with, we wanted to know a bit more about this. So she put that on Reddit. She just started a Reddit thread and said, if you've become a Christian through reading the Bible, which bit of the Bible have you read? And the she got 179 answers yesterday and they were all different.
Wow.
So people are just finding faith through Scripture. So incredible. So something shifted, hasn't
yeah.
it? It's hard to know exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a new season.
Yeah, well, it was really exciting to hear that and stories from yourself and other Christian ministries saying similar. SPCK, the Christian publisher, said Bible sales are through the roof, again, just a few weeks ago. So it's really interesting to hear you pinpoint it to 2023 23 for just for your own experience and what you're seeing as Fusion and students. Now, obviously, in working with students, you are working predominantly with Generation Z. So how much of this is a generational shift? How much of this is... I'm a millennial, so I grew up in a time where Richard Dawkins was being talked about a lot, and the God delusion, and there was a sort of narrative that science and faith were in conflict and Christians didn't really have any good answers to these big problems and science was sort of the saviour. That was some of the things in the water. I get the impression now that Generation Z, they're just not living in that world or that culture. There's this kind of new openness. Tell me more about that side of what's going on.
Firstly, I love that you say Generation Z. I assume you're avoiding Gen Z.
Of course. Very adorable. Deliberately. I mean, Gen Z. I'm happy for our American friends, and they can carry on calling. They can carry on mispronouncing it, but I'm going to carry on saying Generation Z.
Yeah, all power to your elbow. So, absolutely, that is a big shift with that particular generation. I think if you imagine if you've done your GCSEs in lockdown and were given your qualifications and didn't sit exams. When that happened, I remember thinking, I'm praying with our team, going, we're going to have these guys arriving at uni before too long. That is a significant difference. So we're going to there'll be some fallout there where there's a level at which they didn't attain what they needed to attain. And that's quite a crucial age when you're becoming who you really are, when you're growing, you're going through adolescence and attaining A-levels or GCSEs. If you're just given them, that's a pretty big difference. And we've seen that play out in the character of people and in all sorts of different ways. I'm just saying it was a big shift. So for those people, they've hit like university where they're really deciding what they're going to live for, what is their life going to be all about. And they've seen seismic change. I'd also say... I personally think, and we were saying this before any of the big news around what's happening right now with this generation, but I'd say this is the biggest missional opportunity since the Billy Graham rallies first came to this country in the 50s. And the reason why, I think there's lots of different reasons why, but there's quite a few parallels that I think are really fascinating. Firstly, there's a new monarch, and I don't think... I think that has more significance than... somebody like me would really like it to have. In other words, there is in terms of dominions, power structures, the government of the, you know, it's quite a big, it does matter. So there's a new monarch on the throne that for us has indicated a new era, new epoch kind of thing. Then I would say the job market is totally uncertain. After in post-war Britain, there was a lot of uncertainty about how are things going to play out. There's global unrest, threat of another massive war, whether that was the Cold War or whether that was what we're now looking at all over the world, and so all sorts of uncertainties. And then also there's uncertainty in the 50s and 60s as computers, in the dawn of computers, there's people going, well, wait a second, we're not going to have any jobs. What does the future hold? It's all going to get done by computers, and we're experiencing the same with AI. Yeah. So there's a bunch of things that leave people asking existential questions. They're like, what am I even about as a human? And then that, just to land on that, I would say that's the key question for this time, particularly for students. In previous generations, the key questions, certainly around Dawkins, was around what is truth? What's reliable? Is this made up? Whereas the big question is around identity now and who the identity of a human. What is a human? Am I a creation? Am I somebody who is made? And that is just a story around that. I remember we had a number of Chinese students give their life to Jesus in one academic year. It was 13 students, basically, because an evangelist who was in an underground church in China came to study in York, and she could not believe, a student called Hong, she could not believe that you were allowed to be out as a Christian. So she's like, I'm going to tell everyone. And so she was going around and led 13. We baptized 13 Chinese students that one year. And one of them was a student called Chloe. She was in week one of being a Christian. She had been reading her Bible, like cover to cover kind of thing, asking big questions. And she'd discovered in Matthew 6, it says, don't worry about your life and all that sort of stuff. And then she said, it says that there's a narrow path. and a broad road. And Jesus says, hardly anyone takes the narrow path. Most people take the broad road. So her discipleship question in week one of being a believer was, well, this can't quite be right because apparently there's 2 billion Christians in the world. So either they're not really following Jesus or Jesus was wrong and loads of people take the narrow path of following him. Which is quite a good question in week one of following him. So she was meeting up to talk about that. But next to her was Melody. And Melody is just along for the ride. They're going to lecture together next on the next kind of slot. So while she's chatting, she's sitting there, Melody sitting there reading her Bible. We had a bunch of Chinese Bibles. So she starts reading it at the beginning, which is where you begin books. So she starts reading in Genesis. They look over and she's streaming with tears. And they're like, is everything okay? They hadn't noticed, really. And she says, yeah, I'm just read that I was made. And in China, they don't tell you that you're made. Never in my life was I told that I was created or made. I just always an accident.
The July issue of Premier Christianity is out now. This month, we explore how people are finding Jesus in 2026. Read the remarkable story of a whole family coming to faith. Pete Hughes on why the Western Church is being revived. And discover how one Alpha invitation became an Instagram journey towards Jesus. Subscribe today for just 60p a week and get full print and digital access to the UK's leading Christian magazine. Head to premierchristianity.com now.
Well, that leads us nicely onto another topic I want to talk to you about, which is discipleship. Mm. As you mentioned just there, even in that story, meeting up to talk about the big questions. Discipleship, it strikes me, is so key, is so fundamental. You won't meet a Christian who doesn't agree that discipleship is important. We're told to go and make disciples of all nations. And yet, it sometimes seems a bit hard for maybe churches, maybe Christians to put into practice in a more deliberate way, let's say. And you wrote a book into this, which I have to say I thought was excellent, which is How to Make Disciples That Make Disciples. And it really contained practical teaching on how we do this. And I wanted to start with, why is it that something so fundamental sometimes isn't happening as much as I think some leaders like to think it is? You have to actually work at it and put things in process to make sure it happens. It doesn't seem to happen as naturally as sometimes we assume, does it?
No, it doesn't. And that's such a good question that I want to also ask of the church. Why are we not doing this? I think Jesus, he gave us the Great Commandment and the Great Commission. He's pretty clear. His strategy is pretty clear. Go and make disciples. He did this. That's what he did. And it was reckless. The disciples he raised didn't really know what they're doing. Some of the people in our church that we need to release opportunity to and leadership to maybe don't really know what they're doing. And by the way, neither do we half the time. We're kind of making it up, aren't we? We're doing our best. But I think there's so many factors around not wanting to release control and whatever that I think we need to trust people more. But I also think we have a system that's designed around a Sunday service. Mm. If I put it this way, probably most people sleep for 7 hours a night. I recognise not everybody gets that much, and some people like a little bit more, but probably 7 hours a night. That leaves us with 100 hours of waking time per week. But we probably, as a church, spend most of our time, energy, resources, and physical buildings orientation around 1% of the waking hour. So if we're really looking to reach the culture, to shape people's life, to make disciples that make disciples, we probably need to spend a lot more of our time in the other 99 hours that people are awake for. And if you look at the cultures in which the gospel is spreading fast, if you look at Iran, if you look at China, if you look at India, if you look at some countries in Africa as well, where it's really spreading rapidly, it's because it's relational and it's released. It's people who are trained, sometimes online. I was chatting to somebody recently who had visited Nigeria, and they had a WhatsApp community where they had 3 million young people in WhatsApp small groups where that's how they are discipling them. But we can't do it all in big meetings, but we still have a structure built for a previous era. Now, I totally think we should have great Sunday services. I love a good Sunday service. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm saying they are not enough because we are having people now coming to faith who don't know anything about the Christian faith. They don't know what's in the Bible. Stories of people just recently who were Christian for 3 months and then learned that Joseph was from the Bible. And she said, I love that musical my whole life, and I just didn't know that story was from the Bible. people that have not grown up in a Christianized culture. So that means they're going to need time and help to figure this stuff out. It's just the stuff of life. Life is complex, and you need somewhere to process that stuff. So I think probably if that happens in a one-to-one place where you've got somewhere you can go and you can talk about things and say, I read this in the Bible, I don't understand this. This happened to me and this person asked me this question and I don't know what I think. Mm. And, you know, this has confused me. Can we pray about that? Mm. Can you help me think this thing through? If you've got somewhere to do that, right, probably then when you go to your small group, you can be a little bit more present for your community. You're a bit more able to engage with those around you and engage with your smaller church network in the small group. And that probably means that if you've got that community there, when you go to church on a Sunday, you're there really to just worship God. And okay, we can do a bit of everything in all of the different places. But what I think is often happening is people are lacking the one-to-one space. Mm. So then they go to their small group, if they go to one, and they probably try and deal with their stuff. So then that leads to quite a lot of oversharing. You know, I don't know if you've ever been in a small group where you're like, okay, you've just said that in front of 14 people. That might have been better to have a one-to-one chat on. But anyway, there we go. So you get those moments, and it's sometimes it's a bit clunky because it's like, this isn't quite working. And then they go to church on Sunday, and really they're just looking for community. Right. They're looking for friendship. And they forget to just glorify God, just to be there, to just go, Jesus, you're amazing. I just want to worship you. So I think if we get this bit right, it helps everything flow.
There's three things there. There's Sundays, there's small groups, and there's one-to-one discipleship.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a sliding scale, right, where you've got 100 Christians going on a Sunday,
yeah,
maybe only 60 or 70 in a small group.
Yeah.
And then maybe only, what, 10, 20 in those one-to-one?
Yeah, which is mad.
You're sort of reversing that and saying, well, actually, you think if you fix the one-to-one discipleship, that will feed into your small groups and make those healthier,
yeah,
which will feed into your Sundays. But it's going back to that basic 100%. One-to-one discipleship.
Because I think actually we love Jesus, but we don't always think his strategy is that great. And that, by the way, is true for the disciples. They thought that too. We're just like the disciples. The disciples were constantly like, really, Jesus? We should not move on from this town to that town because people are getting healed here. Let's stay here. And Jesus was like, no, we're going to Jerusalem. We're on our way. So they moved somewhere else. Or he just disappears and prays for the night. And they're like, seriously, mate, this is terrible timing. Like, they thought they knew strategy better. There's far too many children knocking around the place. Let's move them out of the way. And Jesus is like, don't stop them coming to me. It's chaos, but let them come. Unless you're going to be more like them, you're not going to receive the kingdom of heaven. So he sees things differently, right? Mm. But his strategy was pretty good. Mm. So when he says, go and make disciples that make disciples, let's not do what the disciples do in the Bible and try and control what he was saying and try and do it differently. I think that's what we do. Mm. I think that's why our churches are shaped the way they are. So my point is, his strategy was actually quite good. If you do the maths on it, I was discipled at university by a guy called Nick. He met up with me and said pretty much every week, might have been every 2 weeks sometimes, and he was like, let's have lunch. I just want to encourage you in your faith. Let's talk about what you're going through, and then let's pray together. It's like an hour, and then bish, bash, bosh, move on, right? It was such a big impact on me. So then I've done that for other people since then. I've met with 50 to 60 people since then in this sort of following 25 years. So it's not that many people, one or two people each year. But if you do the maths on it, if throughout somebody's life, they might encourage 20 other believers, they might meet up with some, or maybe not believers, by the way, you might disciple someone before they're a Christian. But if you met with 20 people, you'd only need six generations of people doing 20 people to get to 67 million people. So if we want to disciple the UK, it's quite a good strategy to release it to the body of Christ.
Yeah. It's a great strategy, but here's the problem.
Yeah.
Someone might be listening to this thinking, yeah, but this is Luke Smith. This is Luke Smith who goes on Christian podcasts, who's running running an amazing Christian ministry in Fusion, who's planted a church. Luke knows his Bible. Luke's written a whole book on discipleship. And the person listening to this might have been a Christian for 30 years, but they might have discounted themselves and thinking, I don't know all the Bible. I don't know if I could really take a teenager or 20-something on. I just don't know if I'd be any... Like, what would you say to encourage that person who actually... They are a mature Christian. They have got things to offer, but they've maybe discounted themselves. Because I think this happens sometimes. People say, I couldn't do that.
It does happen all the time. And I really would want to encourage that person to say, you absolutely can do this because you're a believer, because you love Jesus, and because it's not about giving right and wrong answers. It's not about that. It's about question asking. Jesus valued question asking way more than answer giving. You've probably heard these stats before. I take them from Martin Copenhaver's book, Jesus is the Question, which is a great book for anyone to read. But he cites in there all of the questions that Jesus is quoted as asking and being asked. So he's asked, he asks 307 questions. He is asked 184 questions, and he only answers three directly. He doesn't get drawn in. He is much more interested in going, here's another question in response to yours. Here's a story. Here's a slightly strange proverb. Here's a quote that to the listeners at the time was a bit off the wall, and the disciples went, what do you mean by that? And like, he's much more interested in deepening someone's journey. So all you need to do is ask questions to disciple someone. And you, if you feel like, I don't know the answer to their thing that they just ask, embrace the fact that you don't have to. It's okay to go, I'm not sure. What do you think? What do you think he was getting at? Let's discover it together. Let's read that scripture again. Let's find it out. Let's pray. Let's ask. And even just to say, I don't know. I agree that that's a good question, and I haven't resolved that myself. There's some core faith things you probably want to have a pretty good idea on. But I think embracing being able to say, I'm not sure, is very important. Mm. And the current generation, Gen Z, can sniff that out a mile off. They know when you're blagging an answer, when you're giving an answer that you think is the right thing, but you don't really believe. Just say, I'm not sure. I think probably something like this, but I don't know. So anyone can do that, especially if you can ask questions.
And how can church leaders encourage that kind of culture in their churches, where it's just really normal, where I guess ideally everyone is in a one-to-one kind of discipling relationship?
Well, I would say start with you. So I would, and just to name this, probably you're going to have to do this for other people where it wasn't done for you. So probably you weren't discipled as a young leader. Most people haven't been. Probably you didn't have somebody else saying, let me meet up with you and just invest in you because you're great and I want to encourage you. That's not happened for most people. So you might just have to do for others what you wish someone had done for you. Or maybe you had it in bit parts, if you know what I mean, by a group of people who'd invested in you. But just go for it. Because if you model it and invest in other people, then they will do it for others. Mm. The way we've written the book is you could go through it and then the last bit is now you go and do this with somebody else. You could follow that book. Mm. I mean, it is designed to anyone to be able to use it. We've written it for students, but anyone could use it to disciple somebody else.
That's great. Well, I always like to hear about creative things we can be doing differently, creative ideas, whether it be evangelism or discipleship. And you guys had quite a creative idea involving a caravan.
Oh, yeah.
So tell me this story.
Well, this is something that we've been dreaming and planning for as Fusion and 24/7 Prayer. So it's a partnership with them. And we know how crucial prayer is. We know how crucial unity is to each of to the student mission landscape. We know that prayer is the key to revival. We don't pray anywhere near enough in this culture. And so we knew those things. We were like, what could we do together? And then we just thought, what if we bought an Airstream caravan? If you don't know what an Airstream caravan is, Google it. It's one of those silver, it's aluminium kind of curved edges. Often they're coffee like trailers at festivals or those kind of things. They look amazing. Anyway, the company's called Airstream. And so we thought, what if we buy one of those and turn it into a prayer room on wheels? So then take it round to every university location in Great Britain. It's going to take a little while.
And it
came out of a kind of dreaming session where we were like, what would we do if someone gave us £1 million? And then we just thought, that's such a good idea. We should just do it and see whether God provides, which he is already in the process of doing. So we bought one. She's called Bessie. She's from 1964. The manufacturers back then gave each of them names. So that's the original name.
Wow.
So 62-year-old, slightly younger than Christianity.
Well, very good. I'm very impressed. You know our age. 65. Yeah, very good.
So
60 even. What, did I say 65?
You did. You just celebrated your 60th
birthday.
Apologies.
We are 60 years old. Yeah, I know I don't look my age.
So in that case, Bessie's ever so slightly older than that. So
very good.
From 1964. And So we've bought that, and it's currently in Winchester being renovated. Wow. And it's being turned into a prayer room. And then we're going to begin in mid-September, and it'll be in every university location. Just to be clear, not on every campus. Like, sometimes there's a campus of Coventry Uni in Scarborough or something. It's not going to be everywhere, but it will be at every university institution one way or another.
And how long will this take to get around?
It's going to take a while, Sam. It's going to take 3 years.
Okay.
So
an
we're going to do...
An Airstream caravan... But with prayer.
So
prayer stream?
There you go. I'm so glad you put it together. That is it. So it's called the prayer stream, which fits, I guess, the flow of prayer. It's a joined up stream of prayers for students here and elsewhere, engaging students in that prayer. You can book an hour in the prayer room. It's that kind of a place, hopefully 24/7 throughout the night in some places. Some places that might be a bit too dangerous to do. We'll see. But in some places, we're hoping we can just do it constantly, maybe with some shuttle runs of teams doing mission out on the nightlife and then switching with people who have been in the prayer room. That we're hoping we'll be able to do evangelism from it and prayer for healing and all sorts of stuff from the prayer stream. Wow. Caravan. So launches September, and we're going to do 3 laps of Great Britain. We could do a more efficient route if we just did one trip slowly going around every place. But people would graduate before it had got anywhere near them. So we're going to do a lap each academic year.
Fantastic.
For 3 years.
That sounds like a really cool idea.
Yeah.
I wish you all the best for that.
Thanks.
That's brilliant. You mentioned prayer and unity, and you said we don't do nearly enough prayer. And you say as well that unity is so central. And you've got a really lovely kind of story around unity that, again, we've been privileged to publish at Premier Christianity. And... I find unity is one of those subjects we all agree as Christians. Yes, unity is really important, but when it comes to actually putting that into practice, especially between Christian organisations, sometimes it can be difficult for all sorts of different reasons. But you, as Fusion and another Christian ministry in UCCF, have a really, I think, wonderfully heartwarming story of how you've worked at this. You've worked at unity and seen a level of breakthrough where both you and UCCF have spoken publicly about a new unity. So if you don't mind just sharing some of that story.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, UCCF is another Christian ministry working with students. So you're both Christian ministries working with students. And maybe that led to some people viewing you in some kind of competition. Just tell us how you've kind of overcome that.
Yeah, they're great. They run CUs, Christian unions, and we work with churches. So it's pretty distinct. But right from the off, when we began, there was a level of territorialism a bit of negativity towards us. Probably an understatement. It was really tricky. Lots of people will have tracked some of that story. And we'd probably, to some extent, got used to that. We'd tried a few attempts to reconcile, and it hadn't gone well. I think if you... we'd probably each reached a stage of like, well, we're trying, but this is not going anywhere. From our perspective, we were thinking, well, we would love to be at peace with one another. We would love to bless you guys and to work. Just, we don't have to do everything together. We'd just love to be co-laborers in the same mission field, basically, and just go, let's bless what you're doing. But I think they weren't able to do that, the people that were involved at the time. So we were extending a hand of friendship. But you know when you're like, you've got to be wise as snakes and innocent as doves. So at the same time, we're like, well, you don't want to get your hand burnt. Mm. So it's just that balance. But I don't want to get so cynical that I will never extend the hand of friendship. Mm. So it's just that was the dilemma. And if you're in this situation, I would just encourage you to keep being brave, keep being courageous, keep extending the hand of friendship to that person or that organisation, maybe that church. So... it was at the start of 2023, and I reached out to the interim leader of UCCF at the time, a guy called Pete Dray, and said, look, do you want to meet up and pray? I don't have an agenda apart from it just be good to pray together. And he said, yes. So we did that. Genuinely, I was really scared going into that meeting. We'd had some difficult meetings in the past, so I was actually shaking a bit with fear going into that meeting. And I was just delighted. It went really well. He was also pleasantly surprised. We struck up a friendship. He doesn't lead UCCF anymore. It doesn't work for them. But we're still friends. We still meet up for lunch every now and again. And I think he's a fantastic guy. It's now led by a different guy called Matt Lillycrap. And yes, he loves his surname. That is how you say his surname. It's a fantastic surname. The two of us have become really good friends. We message all the time. Both of us love a voice note. We both walk dogs. And so we often send each other long voice notes while walking our respective dogs. But we text most weeks about ministry, but also about the news, also about sport, also about our families. Both of us have been praying for one another's families. So what I would say is we've learned to waste time on each other, in the best sense of the phrase, wasting time on each other. Relationship takes time. People take time, doesn't it? So I think we've learned to not be so task focused that we'll only speak to each other if it's about a ministry thing. So we'll just chat. He's got into watching golf, even though he doesn't play. I play golf. He doesn't. But he's got into it because he knows I do. And then we've talked about that. I love cricket, but I've watched more of it, so I can talk to him about it because he loves cricket. So that's been really good. And I would encourage anyone who's listening or watching this and just thinking, yeah, but it's a complex story. Mm. I'm like, yeah, so is every story like that.
It can happen all over the place, whether it's the church down the road, you know, locally, local churches not getting on, or even just in our personal lives with family members or whoever, where there's broken relationships. It's a really lovely story of how that's been healed. And more than that, not only have you built and healed a relationship, you've actually started to do things together, haven't you?
Yeah, so we ran something called Do It Again, not just us, with other student mission organisations as well. But I guess realistically, with the two sort of bigger student mission organisations here, and certainly in England and Wales. We worked with those organisations, but really we sort of drove it to say, let's just get CUs, churches, other student mission organisations like Christendom Sport and Friends International and Agape and Navigators. Let's just get together and just pray. Let's worship God and pray for revival in our universities. Mm. Let's pray for God to move. And it's been fascinating to see it. And just let's be real. We debriefed about it just recently. It's clunky in some places. You've got like some people who are coming from really quite a conservative place and some people who are coming from really quite a charismatic place, and them trying to work out which worship songs do we do and don't do. And, you know, that's the real talk. Yeah, it's not always easy.
And people praying things who someone else in the room thinks is a bit off the wall and vice versa.
Yeah, totally. But but we've tried to encourage
the reality, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And we've just said, and go with that, and also get to know one another, like Matt and I were able to do, and say we've become friends. Become friends with those people. Mm. Even if you don't have to agree with everybody about everything. Yeah. You might think some of their things are a bit offensive coming back to that's all right.
Yeah.
But just get to know one another, spend time with each other, waste time with each other, and then it'll work.
Yeah. Well, it's a great story, you know, demonstrating it's not easy, but it is important. And Jesus asks us to be unified, and it's wonderful to hear. I think it's encouraging for those of us outside of this world to hear a story like that and think about what is possible when you work at it and you're willing to go for it prayerfully. And as I say, for the rest of us to think how we apply that principle in our own lives. We like to talk about the tough stuff here on the show.
Yeah.
Premier's never shied away from real life. So with that in mind, if you don't mind talking about actually something that happened in your own personal life with your health,
I
understand you had a very serious cancer diagnosis a number of years back.
Yep.
What happened and how? What was faith like in a moment like that of being told some really serious bad medical news?
Yeah, that was in 2012. I was speaking at the Frontline student weekend away in the Knock Christian Centre near the Lake District. And I was experiencing some serious abdominal pain. I remember asking their student team to pray for me. And I was like, I will do these talks, but genuinely, I'm in like a 6 out of 10 pain all the time. But every now and again, it goes up to like a 9 or 10. It's really agony. So I don't know how I'll get on with preaching. Anyway, I did it anyway. And some reason I managed to do it. At the end of that day, I drove home in so much pain, ended up in bed, just rolling around in agony. We had 2 kids under 2. Aaron, our youngest, was 3 months, and Morgan wasn't quite 2 yet. And Hannah was my wife. She's just saying, "Look, you're going to have to go to hospital here, but I can't drive you because we've got the 2 kids in bed. How are we going to manage this?" So I end up getting an ambulance in, and I sit for 7 hours on a stacker chair, just just so uncomfortable, waiting for, you know, just please see me. But there was it was Saturday night, and that's not a good time to go to A&E. I was slightly amusing anecdote alongside it, but I was behind in the queue. I was behind two blokes who were best mates, who had got very drunk. They were probably in their 40s, and they'd had a massive argument while they were drunk and stabbed each other. And then they'd apologised, made up, and they were best mates again, and they were in A&E to get sorted. And they were going, oh, let's never stab each other when we argue in the future. And I'm like, you idiots, you're ahead of me in the queue here. Anyway, eventually I got seen, and they diagnosed that it was bowel cancer. And that's the reason I was in so much abdominal pain, and nothing could pass through because my bowel, which is normally the sort of width of a hose pipe, had expanded because it was blocked with a tumour, had expanded to the size of a rugby ball. And apparently the surgeon, when he operated, said he reckoned it was about 3 hours from bursting. And if that had happened, that would have all gone into my peritoneum, your insides, and I would have died of sepsis. So I was about 3 hours away. The cancer had spread. So I had surgery to remove it all, and I had a colostomy. That was emergency surgery. They didn't know what they were going to find. So when I went under anaesthetic, I didn't know what a colostomy was. So I woke up from the operation, and my bowel was sticking out of my stomach. And that is quite a moment to get your head around, what is that? And they're like, that is where you go to the toilet from now on. And I'm like, what? My world is just like crazy. So I had to get used to that. They didn't tell me it was cancer until 2 weeks later because they wanted me to recover from the surgery and they didn't want me to get negative. So they got me up and running a bit more. And then they said it was cancer. It was a tumour and it has spread. So we're now going to have to do 6 months of chemotherapy and we're just going to have to blast you with it. And that was brutal. They said that there's a 40% chance that it will return anyway. But I guess I was like, there's a 60% chance it won't. Yeah. And that sounds better to me. However, I have to say, so your question around how did we cope with that year, I became convinced I was going to die. And obviously I was wrong. I will die one day, but I was wrong that I thought I was going to die within a year.
Did you tell people that? Like, did your
wife I told a few people that, and just being honest about it, no one really knew what to say. Mm. And I do understand that a lot of people just kind of went, ugh, I'm really sorry, or you know, that's awful. They just didn't have a framework for it. But Matthew Porter, who was the vicar at St. Michael the Belfry at the time, and we're at G2, we're connected to St. Michael the Belfry, so I met up with him regularly. And I said that to him. And he said, yeah, maybe you will. I mean, who knows when any of us are going to die. So he said, well, let's assume you are going to die in a year. If you are, what are you going to do differently? If you've got a year left, what are you going to do differently? I was like, that is the transformational thought. Because I thought, in that case, I would, if there's anyone I haven't forgiven, I would forgive them. If there's anyone where we've fallen out, I'll reconcile if I can. If there's anyone, any way I can be extra generous, I will. There's certain people that I wanted to honour. So I started a blog called the Honour Blog and just wrote honouring things to people. Basically, particularly English people, we're terrible at telling people when we really think they're ace. Mm. We're pretty good at telling people when we don't think they're great. But if you just think someone's wonderful, we're not so great at saying to the world, this person's fantastic. So I thought, I'm going to get that right. So I did an honour blog and just honoured a bunch of people throughout my life and started to live more freely. And I actually thought, in that, I discovered a little bit of the secret of how we're meant to live anyway. Jesus knew he didn't have long. He left it all out on the field. He just went for it, didn't he? And he taught his disciples to do the same. The early church thought that Jesus was going to return in their lifetime, and Paul has to explain to them what going to sleep means and why this is not actually happening. But we've gone so far now, 2,000 years later, that we've deluded ourselves into assuming it's going to be another 2,000 years before Jesus returns. And we live in such a safe world, particularly in this country, I mean, in this culture, where we're able to live for a long time in general. So most of us assume we've got ages yeah. and that Jesus is going to come back in millennia.
Yeah.
So we live with a sense of non-urgency. I actually think we're not meant to live like that. We're meant to live with a sense of the shortness and preciousness of life. Yeah. And then you might get a lot done. Yeah. You never know. You might live a long time. Apparently Churchill believed he was going to die young because his dad and granddad died before they were 30. So he lived with the verve of somebody who thought, I'm going to die before I'm 30. And it was only later in his life he discovered they both died of syphilis because they were sailors. But anyway, so he lived a long time. But he lived with the verve of somebody who thought, I haven't got long left, yeah. so I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's how we're meant
to live.
Just the way to
do it. Gosh. So what was faith like?
If yeah.
you were thinking, I think I've only got a year to live. Was there a sense of, I mean, it sounds obviously like a very difficult thought, but where was faith in that? Was it, well, you know, I'm going to be with Jesus, or was it like, this is just absolutely terrible. I have a young family. God, yeah. what are you doing?
Great. So there's two ways of looking at that. Firstly, for me, I guess I knew, well, it's to live is Christ, to die is gain. This is going to be better. Mm-hmm. If I do die, I'm going to be with Jesus. And I think you also exit time and I would be instantly in the presence of those I love. So I didn't really mind from a personal perspective, and I became quite comfortable with that idea. However, you leave behind people who do live for years, and that for me is the agony. Mm. That's the difficult thought.
And your kids were under two.
Two kids under two, yeah. So... I called it the year of hope. Hannah, who is a fantastic pragmatist, called it, I probably can't say the word actually, but the year of poop, we'll call it. But she maybe used a different word, just because it was characterised by that. It had hit the fan massively yeah, yeah. in terms of our life plan. And we were also kind of joking because She had two kids in nappies. I had a colostomy bag and she was the only one using the loo. So the thing was characterised by this. It was just bowel cancer. Yeah. You've got to be able to have that kind of humour in the mix somewhere because it is messy.
Yeah.
So it was practically difficult, but she held it all together. Mm. But we did have... This is helpful for people to hear, I think, because we did have to, in our marriage for that season, journey slightly differently. And then we learned to have points of connection, moments of making sure we were checking in and connecting together. But I had to face death. She had two kids under two, breastfeeding one of them, and going, I have to hold this together. Mm. I can't conceive of you dying unless they tell us he's going to die, mm. in which case she'll have to face it. But she was like, I can't go there no. in this kind of, yeah. you know, big kind of wondering what if. She was yeah. like, I have to keep the show on the road.
Yeah.
So then when at the end of that season, when it turned out that I was probably going to be okay again, when I was fitter and healthier again, I remember Hannah say, she is Hannah the planner and she is phenomenal. And she basically said on a weekend, she was like, I'm going to have to fall apart now because I've been holding it together because we've needed me to make life work. But I've got so much trauma and processing to do. I'm going to have to fall apart a bit. Mm. And because it was so planned, it was like those videos of where you see a high-rise building being, you know, in a really planned way. Being she just fell apart. And then over the course of the next year, God just rebuilt everything within her stronger than it was before. Yeah. It was stunning because she gave room for the Holy Spirit to minister in that way. But people probably need to hear that as well. Like, it's difficult. It's not just glory yeah. story.
And it affects the whole family. I mean, you've shared some of your story. You're very kind of sharing some of her story as well. And my goodness, what she went through is its own thing, isn't it? And,
yeah.
Well, praise God you're here.
Yeah.
And have you tried to sort of retain that sense? It sounds like one of the massive lessons from that was like living as if you don't know when your last day is. Have you tried to sort of keep
Absolutely.
That mentality, even though now you are fit and healthy?
Yeah, because we really don't know. I mean, God knows that. I personally believe each of us have a number of our days. It's written in his book. That I don't think that day really changes, but we don't know when it is.
Yeah.
So I think it's better to live like that. I certainly try and do that. And I also challenge myself and our church and wider churches to think, what would you do if you knew you only had a year left as a church? How, back to our discipleship conversation, what would you do differently with your resources? what if Jesus said, hey, I'm coming back in a year? And by the way, I realise theologically that's awful. I'm not saying he's going to do that. But if you did know Jesus is going to return in a year, would you still spend your budget in the same way? Mm. Are you sure you would do that? Mm. How would you do anything more to share the gospel with people who don't yet know the love of God? Mm. What would you do differently? I think we would redeploy things because we are storing things up in barns. We are, aren't we? We are planning for millennia to come. Mm. We don't need to.
Yeah.
Let tomorrow worry about itself. I think. Yeah.
It's a great
focus
word.
On today.
It's a great word. What would you do differently if you knew you only had a year left? Profound. Thank you so much, Luke Smith, for sharing with us today. It's been wonderful to hear about your life and Fusion and all the other things we've mentioned. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Sam.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.